In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Welcome. Glad you're joining us today here on the I Spy Radio Show, where every week we help you get a little more intelligence on big government. And that, of course, is the political left. Those on the right want as little government as possible. Less government, more freedom with varying degrees, but it's really all about smaller, less intrusive government, staying out of our business and our businesses, where people control their own destiny. The left wants more control, and the only way to do that is bigger government. And that's all forms of controlling government, whether it's so-called Democrats, socialists, fascists, Nazis, Marxists, communists. It's all about having the power to control. It's its own weird sickness, really, and all those leftist controlling forms of government, regardless of the level and severity of it, at their heart, leftist governments don't trust people, while expecting the people they rule to trust government. In fact, as we see too often, people on the left really don't even seem to like people. It's why communist governments think nothing of killing millions. Today, we'll continue looking at why you should not trust government. Every day, we're finding out more and more that the government has lied about COVID, and now they're lying about the vaccines. And that's the hallmark of those on the right. Don't trust government, trust people. I'd like to welcome Dr. Henry Ely back to the show. He holds a doctorate in naturopathic medicine and is board certified in holistic nutrition. He's also the founder and executive community director of the Energetic Health Institute. Dr. Ely, thanks for joining us today.
Mark, it is so good to be back. Thank you both so much for having me on. It's a joy.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's great to have you back on. We had such great feedback from people. They totally enjoyed your last appearance here. Mm-hmm. So there's a legal concept called fruit of the poisonous tree. And basically put, it means that evidence that is obtained illegally taints any fruit or additional evidence that is gained as a result of that initial illegal evidence. The source is tainted and anything mm-hmm. from it is also tainted. And I mention that because this is really where we're at, conceptually speaking, in terms of COVID. There were lies right from the beginning about COVID. The poisonous tree was that COVID-19 was a natural virus from bats that ended up in a food mm-hmm. market and then spread like wildfire through China. And before they knew it, it had spread to other parts of the world because people who were asymptomatic were like typhoid Marys. Mm-hmm. We know mm-hmm. now none of that was true. Mm-hmm. And because of those untruths, that poisonous tree, in my mind, everything that has followed should be considered suspect. So what are your thoughts on this, and why did they lie to us about the origins of COVID-19?
Well, you know, I think two things about this. Number one is I'm always brought back to Maya Angelou's quote, when someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time, mm-hmm. you know. And when somebody lies to us right out of the gate, it makes it impossible for me to trust anything else that they can then say, and it's something of this magnitude. I remember early on, you know, we were very concerned that, yes, this was gain of function research, or if that's not the specific term, if Dr. Fauci wants to, you know, try to be exonerated by nuance, it was certainly lab enhanced and certainly was not zoonotic. And I think that's the key thing that we have to come to grips with, that we were lied to in a major way. This came out of a lab, Wuhan Institute of Virology, likely in cahoots with work at Chapel Hill, UNC Chapel Hill, and definitely with the aid of American taxpayer funding. And that's my big concern there, because we have people essentially playing God and opening mm-hmm. Pandora's box. And then whether you were studying it for altruistic purposes, which I doubt, or whether you were studying it as a bioweapon, which I think is more likely, especially when we understand that the spike protein is enough to be injurious. That was confirmed in a study by the University of California at San Diego in conjunction with the Salk Institute over the last couple weeks. When we see that, then what it tells us is that this is a weapon. This can injure the body, and whether it comes in a natural form, whatever that means, you know, if it's lab enhanced or if it's at the end of a syringe, it doesn't matter. It's still injurious to the body. So when people, I don't trust people very easily, you know, Mark, and especially elected officials, appointed officials, people that have vested financial interests and things. I just don't trust them. My life has just taught me not to be trustworthy. Your trust has to be earned. And
especially from government sources, I mean, the default position should be that the government is lying to you. And we see that time and again.
I think the world we should create is a world where the government, where we can have this trust in our governments again, right?
Sure.
But that means that we have to be able to hold people accountable, and which means that every single person in an elected or appointed official status that takes an oath, they have to prove what they're saying. And what has really bothered me about this was they came out and just said it's zoonotic. But where was your proof? Mm-hmm. Right? They came out and said it. Well, it's not an accident that Peter Daszak of the Echo Health Alliance, Dr. Shi, and Anthony Fauci all want it to be zoonotic when they know better.
Sure.
That's, you know, and now what you're doing is on the most important thing of our lifetime, the most important event of our collective lifetimes, you have lied at the first step on it.
Right.
Then you're going to tell me I'm going to have to stay 6 feet away from people. Where was the empirical evidence on that? That's a lie. You just made up a lie. What about masking? There is no data to support any greater than a 1.2% possible, you know, impact on mitigation throughout the world. 1.2%.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. And this is from the CDC Europe. Give me a break. That's a lie that masks are safe and effective. That's a lie that masks saves lives. That's a lie.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you want to restore trust in the government and the healthcare industry and, you know, these health departments and whatnot, you've got the first step to do that is to stop lying. But this entire pandemic has relied exclusively on bad data from the start, which led to bad computer models on how many would die, bad data on how many had it, bad data on transmission, especially asymptomatic transmissions, bad data on how many actually died from COVID and not just with COVID, and now bad data on how many are being saved by their solutions, the vaccines. And by bad data, I mean falsified data. So what are your thoughts on the data? Can it be trusted at any level, or has it all been jimmied to spread fear and lead to the vaccine?
Well, you know, you would be more accurate at this point, Mark, if you just took a dry erase board and wrote any arbitrary number you want for any of the categories they have. That's how compromised our data is. And I can prove that statement. That's not just me being facetious or trying to be hyperbolic for a headline. That is a factual scientific statement. The data has been so fraudulently compromised from day one. And really, day one for us is going to be March 24th, 2020, when they changed the definition and the guidance on death certificates. Certificate reporting only for COVID-19 and without public comment, scientific review, without registering it in the Federal Register as they're required to do by law, and without any foresight as to the implication that it has for all statistical comparisons of infectious diseases moving forward. You can literally not compare COVID-19 statistics with any other infectious disease. And here's the dead giveaway that this is an intentional attempt at fear-mongering. Every January 1st of every year, we reset the board for every known infectious disease, every known degenerative disease, every known statistical marker so we can get the count, because we count things annually. They have never reset the count for COVID cases. They have never reset the count for COVID fatalities. And so what they're showing you is a complete fraudulent aggregation of data. And we just look at Alameda County in California, Oakland City, did a soft audit last week of just removing obvious things, obvious death certificates that should not have ever been counted as COVID. 25% of their fatalities over 411 of theirs came off the top. When that's not even reviewing CT values and cycle threshold and PCR, a 25% correction on a soft correction, it's unconscionable.
It's absolutely crazy. And if you can't trust the data, we're right back to the fruit of the poisonous tree. How can you trust what follows? Okay, let's go and take a break. The vaccine's got emergency use or authorization, which means the pharmaceutical companies couldn't be held liable for adverse effects. But to get that authorization, there should not have been any other viable treatment alternatives, which there were. We'll talk about that next with Dr. Henry Ely.
You're listening to the iSpy Radio Show.
And welcome back. We're talking today to Dr. Ely. He's the lead author on 5 research papers on COVID-19, including COVID-19 Restoring Public Trust During a Global Health Crisis, which details extensive acts of willful misconduct of public officials and their response to COVID. And there have been plenty of those. And we're talking today about the vaccines, a continuation of some sorts from last week's show with Dr. Peter McCullough. If you have not heard that show, I highly recommend it. It's available on iSpyRadio.com to download that, or you can just go to your favorite podcasting platform and you'll find it there. So, Dr. Ely, these vaccines have had serious issues. As of June 4th, VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Effects Reporting System, had 6,246 deaths and over 337,000 injuries in connection with these experimental vaccines. Let's look, though, at the vaccine's emergency use authorization. By law, they can only get that if there was an emergent need and there were no other viable treatment alternatives. So why hasn't there been a lawsuit stopping these vaccines? Because there have been so many adverse effects stopping these vaccines, since there are, in fact, viable, proven treatment alternatives.
Well, we know, number one, that the scientists from the United Kingdom have formally called for a halt as of last week for all ages. We know in the United States that we have attempted injunctive action. I've worked with several attorneys and their teams have attempted injunctive action at least for specific age ranges. You know, most recently, the children that are going to be from 12 to 18. And we do know that there's a special session at the CDC and ACIP called for tomorrow, Friday, on this. So there's been people attempting to create injunctive action, but what's happened in almost every case is judges are throwing these cases out. And they're saying that there's either no standing or the case is not argued properly or something like that. And so they're creating these arbitrary and capricious rulings that aren't technically rulings. We can't even get into a courtroom on some of these very pressing issues, which is very disconcerting, to be quite frank with you.
Sure. Absolutely. So you have some of what we're dealing with is just, I think, not only misconduct from public officials, but really malfeasance in some ways from the medical system itself. And you have a personal story about the medical system's response to COVID. Why don't you tell our audience about that?
Well, you know, with the, keep it simple. My brother was diagnosed last week with pneumonia. All right. He was having trouble breathing, was having some symptoms that seemed like COVID, went in, got a chest x-ray, got a positive confirmation that there was fluid building up in his lungs. They assume that the source cause was SARS-CoV-2 virus, COVID, did a test on him, came back positive a couple days later. The problem was that after he got diagnosed with pneumonia, rather than them hospitalizing him, at least for overnight observation, making sure that he wasn't dehydrated, different things like that, they sent him home, Mark, without any treatment. They sent him home and said, if this gets worse, if pneumonia gets worse, come back in three or four days and then we'll consider treating you. That's unconscionable.
Oh, absolutely.
In medicine. Okay. That's unethical. It's immoral. It's wrong. And so luckily I worked with another physician, licensed physician in the state that he lives in. And we came up with an integrative protocol that used ivermectin. And then he didn't really like the corticosteroid that they use, so we didn't use that too much. A little bit of doxycycline, he didn't use that very much at all either. But high-dose nutrient therapy, vitamin D, vitamin A, vitamin C, and zinc. And that integrative approach with ivermectin and all of these nutrients, Mark, took his O2 saturation, which is how much oxygen is on the blood, from about 88%. It was fluctuating between 84 and 88% before we initiated treatment. It took it up to a peak of 95% within 2 days, but it was hovering right around 93%. And that is the biggest sign of positive response to therapeutic intervention is the O2 saturations in these people. So what normally takes people, and he's fully recovered after 9 days of treatment, which is great. He only did 5 days of ivermectin. But what's so really awesome about this is what normally takes people over 3 weeks to recover from pneumonia and requires hospitalization, we were able to help someone recover without any hospitalization and in 9 days. So think of that in terms of economic savings because of the use of ivermectin, which is very affordable, and the nutrients, which are very affordable, and not needing to be hospitalized because this is not something that there are treatments that exist. We can't keep pretending that they don't exist, especially when you have results, clinical results like this that should just be sent out through CNN and Fox and all over the world saying, hey, you don't have to worry. There are options. And if you are want to wait until the clinical trials end in 2023 for these experimental COVID biologics, what some people are calling vaccines, go for it. You can wait because you don't have to worry because we know how to treat this so that you won't die.
Well, see, and that's the crazy thing here. In a news release that you had sent out recently, you mentioned that there were 691 published studies detailing safe and effective treatments. Mm-hmm. Your own brother went through this and was able to recover. Mm-hmm. We didn't have to spend billions of dollars on these vaccines, especially for a disease that has a 99.5% recovery rate on average. So why is there this notion out there that there's no research or clinical support for some of these alternative treatments?
Because the people saying it are lying. We need to stop complicating things here. Anyone at this point in time, 17 months later, that is asserting that there are not safe and efficacious treatments, that the scientific literature is not substantiating that over and over again, that countries throughout the world and people in clinical practice are not substantiating that over and over and over again, are straight up boldface lying. And when you look at why they're lying, they're always ties to the vaccine and the vaccine industry. Because what are we seeing in Moderna? What have they put out there? They're recently their fifth newest billionaire since this came out.
Yeah, crazy.
Don't tell me this isn't about money. It's repugnant in my opinion.
In terms of the medical profession itself, it seems like a lot of doctors, maybe the majority of them, have knuckled under on this and collectively shrugged their shoulders and said, well, we'll just wait for the vaccine. But as you said, the doctors had to know that there were treatments available. I mean, you go through medical school to learn this sort of thing. Why do we even have doctors if all they do is whatever the government tells them to do? I mean, seriously, we could have vending machines to do the work that the medical community is doing right now.
Don't make that suggestion. That's what they want.
Yeah, maybe I should keep that one to myself. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. Come back. We'll be talking more about some of those vaccines and the less safe they look. It's just getting crazy out there. Thankfully, there are some alternatives, and we'll go through some of those next. And welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Henry Ely. He's the founder and executive community director of the Energetic Health Institute based right here in Portland. You can find out more about them by heading to energetichealthinstitute.org. And we've been talking today about the vaccines, some adverse effects from them. And you have an incredible story in one of your recent newsletters, Simone, a student there at Northwestern. Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell our audience about that?
This is heartbreaking, Mark. And I just want people to imagine being a mom or dad for this little girl, okay? So this little girl, 19 years old, and of course, we're all old enough. I can call a 19-year-old a little girl, right? I'm a super duper dad at this point. I'm damn near 50. But she's in Northwestern. She's on campus. The experimental COVID biologics become available for her age range. As soon as the first day she's able to get it, she goes and gets it. No sooner does she get it than she starts having cardiovascular issues. And what we find out later is it's myocarditis, the exact thing that's being investigated tomorrow by the CDC and ACIP in their emergency hearing, especially in this teenage age range. This is in April. She starts having symptoms, a lot of problems. She goes to the doctor. They think it's another infection. They don't think it's from the experimental COVID biologics. So they misdiagnose her. They start giving her antivirals. They start giving her anti-inflammatory medications. Nothing is improving. She calls her parents and says, hey, I'm really feeling bad. They try to get in touch with her the next day. They can't get in touch with her. They start frantically calling campus police to go and check on her in her dorm room. Campus police at first say, no, we're not going to check on her. It's just a missing person. These kids are doing whatever they're doing. Wow. They implore the campus police. The campus police finally acquiesce, finally go in and check. And what do they find? The parents' worst nightmare. The girl is unconscious in her dorm room. They evac her emergency to the hospital. The doctors confirm that she is in cardiac failure due to myocarditis. The parents, of course, are beside themselves. The doctors say to the parents, the only potential we have to save your daughter now, who should have never had access to this experimental COVID biologic, not with a recovery rate in her age range of 99.987%, let alone not pre-screening her to see if she had already recovered and had antibodies and didn't need the experimental COVID biologic in the first place. They tell the parents, the only solution we have is a full heart transplant. They find a donor, okay? They do open heart surgery on this little girl, give her a new heart. 3 days later, she dies.
Wow.
3 days later, she dies. Why? Because her body is still producing the spike proteins even during the heart transplant.
That is just absolutely chilling. And what is so tragic about that and these deaths and these severe reactions is that these are young people. As you said, they had almost no chance of dying if they got it, but they were scared into getting these experimental vaccines, either scared into it or at least believe that it's the savior of mankind thanks to the government, mm-hmm. the media, and social media. Mm-hmm. It's a tragedy.
Because of the lies. They've been lied to. They've been primed and conditioned to think that they can trust their government, their officials, their public health departments, all this stuff, the pharmaceutical, the vaccine manufacturer. They think they can trust all these people, that these people care about them. The reality is they've put enormous protections in place so that these parents can't even sue the manufacturers for wrongful death unless they can prove willful misconduct, which they can.
Well, I think there are going to be a slew of lawsuits coming forward, and I pray for that day to get here sooner than later. But in the balance of the time that we have left for this segment, there are alternate treatments out there that are effective. We've already talked about your brother recovering. And in your recent news release, you mentioned some of these. You mentioned vitamins D, C, A, and E, zinc, quercetin, as well as ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, and budesonide. These are all viable treatments, but you mentioned some others from research published by the University of California at San Diego in conjunction with the Salk Institute. Talk to us about those because I'd never heard of those.
Right. Well, we've been hearing for a long time that things like L-arginine were really effective. And we know L-arginine as an amino acid becomes nitric oxide in the bloodstream, and that is a vasodilator. It makes it so it's going to help the blood really flow with a lot less pressure, right? This is something we use for people who are hypertensive, you know, in the natural world. Well, what we found out through the research from University of California, San Diego, and the Salk Institute is it actually helps immediately heal. Nah, I shouldn't say heal, but actually immediately responds to any pro-inflammation from the spike protein. So if you really wanted to be safe, you would give people who are electing to use their constitutional freedom to get these products, you would tell them afterwards, we need you to take vitamin D, vitamin C, vitamin A, zinc, treat it like an artificial infection. It is, your body's being infected, right? And then also give them L-arginine to reduce the possibility of myocarditis and cardiovascular inflammatory events. They also showed phosphatidylcholine as very effective at being a vasodilator, something I had never even heard of. This was groundbreaking research and my mind is blown on it. But they also showed something that does specifically reverse the damage caused by the injurious spike proteins, N-acetylcysteine. So now here's where it gets crazy, Mark. We haven't confirmed this yet, but we know that the FDA was taking public comments a couple weeks ago because they wanted to remove NAC, N-acetylcysteine, from the marketplace. So you had to go to a naturopath if you wanted to get it prescribed, even though it has zero injury history in our country.
Why on earth were they doing that?
Well, that's pretty curious, isn't it?
Yeah, unless you're trying to cause harm, that just doesn't make any sense. Real quick here, unlike the government, I do not believe that we're all robots, we're one size fits all. So everyone should be talking to their own individual doctor here. But it sounds like everyone should be on at least a regimen of vitamins D, C, A, and E, as well as zinc and quercetin. Is there anyone who would not get some benefit from those?
You know, I mean, there's always going to be a zebra. In medicine, we say there's zebras, you know, people that just don't fit any known textbook situation. Sure. That we're taught, right? So you can never say 100% for anything. But when you understand that 65 to 85% of Americans are deficient in vitamin D alone, when you understand these kind of things, let me read some stats that the CDC has known for at least 20 years, okay? At least 20 years. Looking at this, where are my notes? Right here. So 35 to 45% of Americans are deficient in vitamin A, 37 to 46% of Americans are deficient in vitamin C, 65 to 95% of Americans are deficient in vitamin D, 60 to 84% of Americans are deficient in vitamin E, and 11 to 15% of Americans are deficient in zinc. This is published information by the CDC from 2016. This is their last study. It's called the NHANES report. And what they do is they go around the country and do blood studies and surveys of what people are eating so that they can estimate just what percentage of our population is deficient in these key immunological nutrients. Well, here's a revolutionary concept. How about we give everybody in our country these nutrients? If we can find $33 billion for a fast-track warp speed experimental COVID biologic and to address vaccine hesitancy, whatever that means, then how about we use some of those billions of dollars to give Americans the nutrients that we know they're deficient in?
I think that makes not only sense, it probably makes too much sense as far as the government is concerned. Okay, let's go and take a break. Stay with us. More with Dr. Henry Ely coming up. We're going to circle back around to trust and some things we should have known. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Henry Ely. He's the founder and executive community director of the Energetic Health Institute based in Portland. He has been closely following COVID-19 since its beginning and has written 5 research papers on it. So now that we've discussed some alternatives to the vaccines, I'd really like to circle back around to them. And in that news release that I mentioned earlier, you discuss a study titled SARS-CoV-2 Spike Protein Impairs Endothelial Function via Downregulation of ACE2, and we'll put a link up to that just in case people want to read that. But this study proves that the spike protein alone is enough to induce both mitochondrial and cardiovascular injury to the body, which immediately calls into the question the safety of this the emergency use authorization. But okay, so let's stop there for a second. The cardiovascular damage we've heard about with the blood clots and all the rest. But what kind of damage can it do to the mitochondria? I mean, those are the power plants of the cells. I mean, that's worrisome.
That's terrifying. Okay. First and foremost, when one of my students sent me this, excuse me, one of my graduates sent me this. She was like, "Doc, I know you've probably seen this. Everybody assumes I've read every research article out there. I assure you, I haven't. So much is dropping every day; it's impossible to keep up." So I got this, and it sat on my desk for my desktop for a couple of days, and I finally went and read through it, and I was like, "Wait, what? What are you talking about?" We have proof that the spike protein alone is enough to injure the endothelial lining of the cardiovascular system. Okay, so that's troublesome right there. What gets really troublesome is the conclusions of the authors. The conclusions of the authors state erroneously, with no proof anywhere in their paper, that the spike protein that is created from the mRNA vaccines, once they co-opt normal cellular function, are somehow different than the spike protein that's on top of the that's associated with the SARS-CoV-2 virus. Number one, no, it's not. They're supposed to be identical. Number two, when you have just the spike protein being enough to injure the body, that right there should disqualify this clinical trial from continuing. That's a clear sign of injury. When you then go into the cellular level and you show that it is not only injuring the system, the cardiovascular system, but if you go into the cell, it's injuring the mitochondria within the cell and killing off mitochondria in the cell. That is more than enough proof to say that what this product that you've put together in concept and have tested and now been distributed should have never made it to market. because it is an injurious product. And this is where you hear Dr. Lee Merritt and Dr. Peter McCullough correctly, in my professional opinion, saying that this is now these so-called vaccines are bioweapons. Yeah. You know, you're injecting something known to be injurious to the human body.
Yeah. Well, and it also begs the question. So the government sanctioned solution, these vaccines, is to inject a trigger mechanism into our bodies, forcing our own cells to create the very thing that causes the problem. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that a bit like saying cyanide is bad, and to prevent that, we're going to trick your body into making its own cyanide in hopes that you might develop an immunity to it?
That's a good analysis. That's a good analogy right there. And we just got our first post-mortem report come in, and I haven't finished dissecting this one with a couple of other doctors I really, really respect in the country. But the early returns are that an 86-year-old man, they did an autopsy on, and they found the spike proteins from the so-called vaccines in every tissue of his body. What that tells us, and this was one of my grave concerns, when you inject the mRNA sequence into a cell, into the body, and then it uploads into the cell, right? And it starts co-opting the ribosomal subunits to produce more versions of itself. Where's the off switch?
Yeah.
How do you turn this off so it doesn't produce it for the rest of the person's life?
That was actually going to be my very next question is, does it ever turn off?
We don't know. And there's no proof that it does. And when we found a leaked report from Japan, the Japanese Ministry of Health, which does something very unique in the world, they actually take the products from these manufacturers and put them up against their own tests, you know, that kind of thing we should all be doing, to see if what the manufacturers say actually is what they found. And what they found in their leaked paper was that there is an incredible affinity for the mRNA sequences in the Pfizer biologic to lodge themselves in
other organs,
ovaries, specifically ovaries and spleen. So this is on the back of what Dr. Michael Yeat and the former chief scientist at Pfizer has been saying. We are very concerned about the likelihood of these mRNA biologics leading to infertility and autoimmunity. Well, guess which two tissues they lodge in?
Yep. Yep.
The ovaries and the spleen. Mm. Infertility and autoimmunity right there.
Yeah. We only got about a minute here or so with you. And I've seen people respond to these deaths and other adverse effects and that the vaccine would normally be pulled after 25 to 50 deaths. And they say things like, well, but those are from much smaller distributions. The COVID vaccines, they've been given to hundreds of millions of people. So 6,000 deaths and a few hundred thousand adverse effects. Yeah, that's really quite small and insignificant. And in fact, they were expecting far more problems. So the vaccines are just great. What would you say to people who respond that way?
That is a repugnant thought. Those people are being offensive to the families of that have lost loved ones who went in trusting their government and their public health officials and this product. It is disrespectful to say something like that, especially on the heels of saying last summer that all lives matter and slamming that into our faces every chance you could get. It's repulsive. It's repugnant. It's un-American. And anyone who's saying it needs to shut up.
Mm. Absolutely agree. All lives matter unless you've taken the vaccine. Then it doesn't matter so much. Well, there is a ton more information that we wanted to get to with you. And we're just going to definitely have to have you back coming up here in July. Look forward to that very much.
Amen. It'd be great to be back.
This is the iSpy Radio Show.
Unfortunately, David Horowitz was unable to join us for our scheduled interview to talk about his new book, The Enemy Within. He had to cancel at the very last moment, but do keep him in your prayers. His wife was in urgent care. We are trying to reschedule that and hope to have him on soon. The following is our interview with him from back in 2014 about the rise of socialism then. Take a listen in this segment and the next, and you'll hear how the groundwork for what's happening today was laid then. You know, we are always trying to better understand the left, what motivates them, their philosophies, and how they operate. And there is probably no better person to help us understand the left than David Horowitz, who was once deeply involved with the left, but has since left the left, and he's joining us by phone. David, it's an honor to talk to you today.
Well, thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about your journey. You grew up in a Communist Party household, and you became one of the founders of the New Left in the 1960s. before you had an awakening in the mid-1970s, your bio on Front Page Magazine calls this a break from totalitarianism, and that you look back on those days in the New Left with anger. I'm sure that you get asked this all the time, what happened, but what happened? What woke you up and why the anger?
Well, 1974, I had raised a lot of money and bought a church in East Oakland for the Black Panther Party and turned it into a learning center. And I recruited a friend to keep the books of the school. And in December 1974, she disappeared. She's the mother of three children. In February, her body floated ashore from San Francisco Bay. I knew the Panthers had murdered her, and all my leftist friends were defending the Panthers. And so that stopped me. I mean, actually, it was a traumatic event for me.
Yeah, I bet.
But then that's the spring of 1975. There had been an election in November. Thanks to Watergate, the Democrats, a lot of left-wing Democrats came into Congress, and the Democrats immediately stopped military, and our troops had been out since 1973 from Vietnam, but they stopped the military and economic aid to Cambodia and Vietnam. And the result was the communists took over both countries and proceeded to slaughter 2.5 million people. And the Democratic leaders who were involved in that, helping the communists to slaughter 2.5 million people, are proud of what they did. Of course, they don't see it in the terms I'm describing. Anyway, that's when I left the left. And then took me, that 75, it took me another 9 years to pull the lever for a Republican, Ronald Reagan, in 1984.
Well, just now you said that the people in the new Congress didn't see it as slaughtering 2.5 million people. How do they see it?
Oh, they see it as ending a bad war. Just the way they see the war in Iraq. That's a bad war. It's a war that we fought against, the first really big war against the terrorists. The Democratic Party is now run, President of the United States is somebody who comes from the exact same background I did. Barack Obama was brought up by communists, and then he joined the new left. It wasn't a new left. It was the same communist left with different language. And that's what he joined, and he's never left it. So we have the radical left in the White House, and they're very clever now. They don't try to do, or their guiding light says not to do, not to exceed what's possible. So in the 60s, we leftists, you know, we said we want a revolution, we want it now. Barack Obama doesn't talk like that. He did say he wanted a fundamental transformation of the United States, and but he knows he has to do it step by step, and that's what he is doing. He's taking down our military. He's made us an international laughing stock when it comes to military power. Our friends don't trust us. Our enemies don't fear us. Our military is being radically degraded. And domestically, he's bankrupting or attempting to bankrupt our economy. I think 70% of the national debt since George Washington has been accumulated by Obama. He's destroying our borders. He not only Obama, but his Valerie Jarrett, who's the power behind his throne, she grew up in an Iranian communist family and has never left the communist left. We, in effect, have communists in power in Washington. And by that, I mean, you know, they don't call for a dictatorship of the proletariat, although they are trying to create a one-party system using the IRS and other measures.
Sure.
Electoral fraud. But they have the same agendas. You know, this idea that you can make everybody equal is an idea behind which over 100 million people were killed, murdered by the communists. Same idea.
We have seen the failure of communism time and again in other countries. So why do people here in the United States keep thinking that it will work here?
Well, you know, every generation is ignorant and has to be educated. And our universities and our K-12 schools have been taken over by the political left. And so our children are being indoctrinated in leftist thought, which is anti-American, anti-capitalist, anti-free market, and anti-individual freedom. They're collectivists. And, you know, you can see it in this, you know, the Ferguson and now the New York case. These demonstrators, you know, a lot of them are just completely ignorant, but
yeah,
basically they don't care about the facts. They don't care that Michael Brown was a thug and they attacked a an armed policeman in his patrol car and was shot because he was threatening the policeman's life. All they care about was he's black. So all black people are alike, and they're all victims, and they're all oppressed. And all white people are guilty. That's the collectivist mentality, and it rules our universities, and that's why you see so many young people out there.
Yeah. We'll be right back with more of our interview with David Horowitz from back in 2014 coming up. Some of the things we should have learned back then, we're still trying to learn now. David Horowitz was unable to join us for our scheduled interview and had to cancel at the very last minute. His wife had been admitted to urgent care. So the following is from our interview with him from 2014. In volume 3 of your book series, The Great Betrayal, you say that modern political debate isn't conducted between two camps seeking the same goals through different means. It is a debate between two wholly opposed worldviews. And if Americans fail to realize the true nature of the left, liberty is threatened. Why is it that so many people on the right fail to grasp this, but instead they keep thinking that they can actually work with those on the left?
Right, because they're slow. I think the right is way too decent and too ready to, and they're afraid of being called McCarthyites or whatever. But these people on the left who are running the Democratic Party are radical leftists with anti-American agendas. This book I've written called The Great Betrayal is about the Democrats' sabotaging of the war on terror from the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993, which Clinton never even visited. There were 6 people killed and 1,000 wounded. Clinton didn't visit the site. The Democrats want to treat terrorists like they're individual criminals and ignore the fact that they are organized behind an idea. And the idea is that Islam must dominate the world, and heathens, infidels, particularly Jews, but also Christians, need to be killed.
Yeah.
That we're at war. The Democrats have, Obama changed the term war on terror to overseas contingency operations. He does not want to concede that there's a war.
No.
Under pressure at a press conference, he may say that, but if he believed it, we'd be rearming our military instead of degrading it, which is what is that, and hollowing it out.
In that book, you talk about some of the lessons that they should have learned under the Bush years. So just real quick, what are some of the lessons that the right should have learned?
Well, look, the Democratic Party committed treason during the Iraq War. It's the only time in American history when we were actually at war. Young men and women were in harm's way that a major political party turned against the war and was stabbing our troops and our country in the back. We were war criminals. We were the aggressors. And the Democrats did this for 5 years. And so in the memory of everybody, when people talk about the Iraq War, either like Republicans, they don't want to talk about it, or they'll say it was a bad war. It was a good war and a necessary war. We defeated the terrorists, and then Obama turned Iraq over to the terrorists.
Yeah. In our first half of the show, we had a guest on. He's a sheriff from Clatsop County talking to us about a youth sexuality conference sponsored by the Oregon Department of Education. And this is an awful thing. It's been making the news up here. It exposed kids as young as sixth grade to pornographic materials and far worse. You know, a lot of what we've talked about with you so far has been about politics, but is the agenda of the left to also assault the American family and American culture?
Well, they're anti-religion. They're anti-family. They're collectivists, and the family is a tremendous obstacle to collectivism. But I think conservatives, particularly in Oregon, need to be very careful about the social issues, and particularly homosexuality, which is genetic. And therefore, it's not political. But I don't want to get into this controversy, but I do think there are a lot of conservative politicians who hang themselves on these issues.
We only got about a minute here. So there's a quote attributed to Norman Thomas. The quote, "The American people will never knowingly adopt socialism, but under the name of liberalism, they will adopt every fragment of the socialist program until one day America will be a socialist nation without knowing how it happened."
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's just like Jonathan Gruber, one of the architects of Obamacare, who said, you know, we have to disguise the fact that it's a tax, because that wouldn't get through if that was the case. And we have to lie about you can keep your doctor and you can keep your plan, because otherwise we couldn't get it through. And so the Democratic Party is a party committed to lying so that they can force people to do what they think is in their interest.
So do you think, is America a socialist nation? And if not, how close are we to it?
Well, we are certainly on our way. I mean, I think the government accounts for 40% of the economy already.
Yeah.
But it's the mentality. It's the culture war that matters. If we have the collectivist view that these people in the streets, these lynch mobs in the streets do, if that wins, we're gone.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the Democratic Party is committed to that view.
Yeah,
and the Democrats have to be defeated everywhere and in every place, including in Oregon.
Absolutely. Could not agree more. David, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you.
That is all of our time for today. We certainly hope that you're at least a little wiser for having been here. We will be having David Horowitz on later in the summer, hopefully in a couple of weeks, as long as his wife gets better, to talk about his new book, The Enemy Within, How a Totalitarian Movement is Destroying America. And boy, do we need that kind of discussion. There are, again, a ton of links on this week's show page on iSpyRadio.com. Do be sure to check those out and share those with your friends and family, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.